Good evening. I'm grateful to be with you tonight as we think about your worldview and morality. I want to go back and start with Isaiah 52 and verse 7. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your God reigns. I bring that up because I want us to understand as we start this tonight, that the gospel is not just a moral system. That is to say that our goal in teaching the gospel is not just to get people to change from one moral system to another moral system. Because we need to realize that just being moral in and of itself is not what's going to save us. All have sinned. And Scripture teaches that the only way to salvation is through the blood of Jesus Christ. And as Isaiah 52, 7 says, it's the peace that's being announced of salvation. And that salvation comes through Jesus. We need to understand that's the biblical teaching about salvation. Still, we understand that morals are a part of what it means to be human. And our worldview as a whole needs to support the moral nature of mankind. We need to realize that morality is greatly affected by our overall worldview. What does your worldview have to do with morality? What is it that makes morality intelligible? And which worldview legitimately accounts for moral responsibility? What's your final, ultimate moral foundation? We made the point yesterday, as Jesus taught in Matthew, the 7th chapter, 24 through 27, that you can build your house on the rock or you can build it on sand. Now, in that context, he's talking about hearing what he says and doing what he says. But that principle of building on a foundation that's solid rather than one that is just going to collapse when the tough things happen in life. I want us to understand that everyone has a sense of ought. And I just call it that in the broad kind of sense. That's not technical terminology or anything like that. But the question is, what explains this? Now, you might say, no, not everybody has a sense of ought. In fact, you ought not to teach this. Well, you've just demonstrated that you have a sense of ought when you do that. When we talk about a sense of ought, I'm not talking about all the specifics of the moral system. Simply that everybody has some kind of sense that some things are right and some things are wrong, whatever those specifics might be. And my question right up front is, what is it that best explains the moral sense that all of us have? Is it going to be a foundation that's built on random, purposeless, amoral chance? Is that even a serious explanation? Or is it going to be a foundation built on intention and purpose and intelligence? Which foundation makes sense of our moral nature? That's the question we're asking tonight. What explains conscience? What explains right and wrong? And we understand, I hope, that everybody has a line that they don't want crossed. Everybody does. Even the person who might commit the most heinous crimes over here is still at some point going to say, at some time, no, that's too far. No, you can't do that to me. Or whatever it may be, there's going to be a line that they don't want crossed. Now, the line may be different for some people, and that's part of the question is how do we determine where that line is? But the fact that we have it is what I'm really getting to right up front here. And what explains that? And who gets to decide then? When we talk about a standard of right and wrong, who makes those decisions about those standards? Who gets to decide that this is right and this is wrong? Or are we just at the arbitrary whims of society? That if society says, well, this is what we ought to do, then we're just going to say, well, then that's what we ought to do. And that's going to change based on the whims of those who are in power and get to enforce those moral codes. If we exist as a result of an intelligent creator, intelligent God who made us in his image, as Genesis 1 teaches, then our moral nature will make sense. Clearly, morality is one of the main issues that sets human beings apart from the rest of creation, even from the rest of the animal world. When's the last time you've seen animals sit around and debate morality? When's the last time you've come home and you've seen your dog really upset because he violated some moral code? I mean, he might realize, okay, I shouldn't have torn up the house, you know, but next time I get a chance, I'm going to do it anyway. But they're not going to sit there and debate moral nature. They're not going to worry about whether or not they violated something. They're not dealing with a bad conscience or anything like that. Why? Why is it that human beings are so different from the rest of creation? Does random, purposeless, mindless chance explain that? Or does intelligence explain it? One of the things we're doing in this series is contrasting worldviews. I want us to understand the difference between the biblical view, the atheistic view. And we're going to be giving some quotes tonight as well. So what does your worldview have to do with morality? Well, the answer is everything. And we want to see how this is so. So as we think about the biblical view of morality for just a moment, we realize, of course, that God is the foundation of all of this in the Bible. He upholds all things by the word of his power. We read of Jesus in Hebrews 1 and verse 3. Or Colossians 1:17, in him all things hold together. He is not just a moral being who is accountable to a higher standard than himself. He is the standard. Holiness is his nature. Sometimes people ask a question to that effect. Well, is God amenable to a higher standard than himself? Well, if he is, then he's not God. You know, there's a statement made in Hebrews, the 6th chapter, about God giving an oath. And we read there that he could not swear by anyone greater than himself, so he swore by himself. In other words, there could be nothing higher to which he can appeal. He is the highest of all. He is the greatest standard of all. There is no higher moral code than God to which he's amenable. God is morality. God is holiness. That is the essence of his nature and who he is. And that's the biblical concept. God, as the creator then, makes male and female in his image, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Human beings then are moral creatures meant to reflect God's holy nature. Humans are morally responsible and accountable for their actions. And of course, we read this throughout the Bible, but a passage like 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10 reminds us we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ that we may receive the things done in the body according to what we've done, whether good or bad. There is a judgment concept there that we will meet the Lord in the end and be accountable for this. But remember that your God reigns. So because of who he is, he has the right to tell us how to think and how to act and how to live. And Scripture provides the principles and the guidelines for moral behavior. And failing in that is what we call sin. And we see the effects of that in a passage like Genesis 3 and verse 5, when the serpent there is tempting Eve and says, you know, as God said, you will surely die. He says, you will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of this, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. The lie right there is that what he's trying to do is get us to determine for ourselves what is right and wrong. If I could paraphrase what he's doing, basically he's telling Eve, you don't need God telling you what to do. You can decide for yourself what's right and wrong. You're your own God, is the essence of that. And really, that's the very same thing we continue to contend with today. Is there a God to whom we are accountable, or are we our own gods, as it were? Do we get to determine for ourselves all these things about moral issues? Well, that all always ends badly. A moral sense is built into the fabric of who we are. And because of our failures to live up to the standard, we need forgiveness. Forgiveness from the one whose nature we have violated. And so the gospel is God's answer to that problem. Through Jesus Christ, we may find that forgiveness, be reconciled back to God, and our forgiveness in that case is not based upon keeping moral laws, but rather the fact that Christ died as a sacrifice for our sins so that we may once again live. We are moral failures. And we cannot just earn our way back into God's fellowship. We're not going to be able to say, okay, I did some bad things over here, but now I've made up for it all by doing a bunch of good things. I did one bad thing and I did 20 good things, so maybe God will owe me something. No, that's not the way it works. Salvation is by the grace of God. We don't earn it. We don't deserve it. We need Christ. Sin leaves us broken. And only Christ, through his sacrificial death, can we have those wounds healed. That's what the gospel is. But we also understand that while being moral by itself can't save us, immorality will condemn us. And we have passages like Galatians 5, 19 through 21, which speak of the works of the flesh. And all the things that are mentioned there we're told that those who practice these things will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. Or in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, the same kind of thing. The sins that are listed there and ending with, those who practice these things cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. So that, we understand, immorality will certainly condemn us. And so Christians believe that our moral nature can really only make sense in the light of the God who made us this way. With God, our morality matters. Actions have consequences. We are responsible, and there will be final accountability. Continuing in sin means being lost, and receiving God's grace through Christ by faith means salvation. There's really no in-between there. Well, what happens, though, when we remove God from the picture? Do morals still make sense? Does it really matter, then, what we do? Will there be ultimate consequences for choosing to live one way or the other? Like what Joel Furches had to say about this, he says, one cannot remove and replace moral laws at one's convenience. If they exist at all, they will occasionally restrict one's freedom to act however one pleases. If they do not exist at all, pity the weak victims whom these laws fail to protect or avenge. What I'd like to do is think a little bit about what the atheistic view is in their own words. I want you to see what they have to say about this. And what I'm trying to do here, and please understand, the point of this is not to make fun of a view or to mock a view or anything like that. It's to see what they say about this particular issue of morality and what it means to remove God from this picture here. Now, I realize that not every atheist would say it the very same way. And I want to be very clear about something here. I'm not saying that atheists cannot be decent people. Do not misunderstand me. They certainly can be. Many of them are. I believe all of us share a common grace from God that have a spark of moral ought within us. And the fact of universal morality speaks to something deep in our nature that I do not believe can be accounted for on the basis of raw, brute materialism. But remember, We need salvation. All of us have sinned. And that's not going to be accomplished just by doing a bunch of good things over here. It's going to be accomplished by submitting to the one who died for us. But what I'm trying to get at is the issue is a worldview issue here. Foundationally, it is a worldview issue. And these quotes that I'll be giving, I want you to see in their own words terms like good or terms like happiness or evil, even things like that, that need further definition and terms that cannot be accounted for by raw material. This comes from the Humanist Manifesto, 1973. We affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous, self-governing, and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. Ethics stems from human need and interest. To deny this distorts the whole basis of life. Now, you see that word basis, that's a worldview term. And my question would be, what exactly is the basis of life? Who defines that? Now, he says, human life has meaning because we create and develop our futures. Happiness and the creative realization of human needs and desires individually and in shared enjoyment are continuous themes of humanism. We strive for the good life here and now. Now, you can read throughout, and Paul Kurtz is the one who wrote this, and his book, In Defense of Secular Humanism, and you're going to lack for definitions of how you define words like happiness and good and that kind of thing. The assumption is that it's there. What they're not doing is going back deeper and really defining where these things come from and who gets to define them. Aldous Huxley wrote, "The philosopher who finds no meaning in this world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, as no doubt most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality." Now, here was an atheist, and I got to tell you, there's some of these atheists that I'll quote that I actually have some appreciation for simply because they're being honest with it. Now, a lot of times, you'll have this discussion, I don't believe in a philosophy of meaninglessness and all of that. But he's admitting right here that giving up this foundation over here means accepting a philosophy of meaninglessness. And that the reason why he says, I accepted this philosophy of meaninglessness is because I want to be able to do what I want to do. I want to be able to decide what's right and wrong, essentially. And it's an instrument of liberation. I get to be free. I don't have to be bound up by anybody's system or moral code. And so what you have here then is this moral relativism, this worldview of moral relativism. The problem, of course, is it cannot be consistently applied. Now, we used this example yesterday, but I think it illustrates well the point. If you're having this discussion with somebody and you say, well, you ought to do this or you ought not to do that, and somebody says to you, well, you shouldn't push your morals on me, the question is then, what are they doing? Because they're turning around and telling you, you ought not to tell other people what to do. But can you see that that is inherently inconsistent? It is self-defeating. I cannot on the one hand say or think you should never push your morals on anybody, and on the other hand turn around and tell somebody what they shouldn't do. If that's really what you thought, you just need to not say anything at all. Because it's a moral statement to say you shouldn't push your morals. And it's self-defeating. So once again, imagine that ethics professor arguing for moral relativism and then demanding that his students not cheat on their exams. Let me ask you this. Who wants to go to a doctor who professes that it's okay to cheat? who professes that it's okay to take shortcuts, or who would profess that it's okay to lie and arbitrarily decide what's ethical based on his own whims. I rather think that probably most of us, when we go to a doctor, do not want a moral relativist. But I'd like to illustrate the problem by asking this question. Why was Hitler wrong? Now, there's an assumption behind that question, and that assumption is that he was wrong. Now, I assume most of us would think that. Once in a while, you run into people who don't think that, and that's another issue. But most of the time, people are going to say, oh yeah, Hitler was off the reservation, really wrong. Why was he wrong? Will moral relativism stand up to the answer there? Because if there's no standard by which you can say that something is good or bad, right or wrong, then we really have no ability to speak to the issue without being inconsistent to the profession of moral relativism. Remember, ideas have consequences. You can't say on the one hand, whatever anybody wants to do goes, and on the other hand, Hitler was some moral beast. Can't do that. One of my favorite atheistic philosophers of the 20th century was Jean-Paul Sartre. And like I said, I like him simply because he's honest. I certainly don't agree with him. But here's what he said. He says, when we speak of abandonment, and he's an existentialist, as they're called. He says, when we speak of abandonment, we only mean to say that God does not exist and that it is necessary to draw the consequences of his absence right to the end. That's right. He's right about that. And he understood well what he was saying. If you read that essay, you could see him explain this whole thing. So he goes on to say that the existentialist finds it extremely embarrassing that God does not exist. For there disappears with him, with God that is, all possibility of finding values in an intelligible heaven. There can no longer be any good a priori, that is, foundationally, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it. It is nowhere written that the good exists, that one must be honest or must not lie, since we are now upon the plane where there are only men. Dostoevsky once wrote, if God did not exist, everything would be permitted. And that, for existentialism, is the starting point. You see that? That's worldview foundation right there. Starting point. What's the starting point? That if there's no God, everything is permitted. And then he says, everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist, and man is in consequence forlorn, for he cannot find anything to depend upon either within or without himself. Now, somebody objected to Sartre. Well, many objected to Sartre, but somebody objected by saying that your values are not serious since you choose them for yourselves. To which he answered, Sartre answered, to that I can only say that I'm very sorry that it should be so. But if I have excluded God the Father, there must be somebody to invent values. We have to take things as they are. And moreover, to say that we invent values means neither more or less than this, that there is no sense in life a priori. Life is nothing until it is lived, but it is yours to make sense of, and the value of it is nothing else but the sense that you choose. So what man needs to do is find himself again and understand that nothing can save him from himself, not even a valid proof of the existence of God. I want you to note the presupposition there. The idea, what Sartre is basically saying is, even if you brought me a valid proof for the existence of God, I'm not going to accept it. What I want you to understand about things like this is it's not about the evidence. It's not like someone like this is going to say, just bring me the evidence and I'll accept it all. He's admitting he wouldn't accept it. And he's basically saying, we're just pulling these consequences out to the very end, and that is, I invent my own values, you invent your own values, that's just the way it is. And everything is permitted. Well, one of the most famous atheists of years gone by, Bertrand Russell, in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, he said this, that man is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collections of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all labor of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All of these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. I just let that sink in a minute. And here he is saying, everything ever accomplished by anybody is buried in a universe that's in ruins, just a bunch of debris, basically. And that we need to stand on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Now again, that's worldview language. Firm foundation. Okay, what's your firm foundation? My firm foundation is unyielding despair, and no philosophy that rejects that can hope to stand. There's some irony in that. I'll tell you what, some of these guys were very eloquent. And I read some of what they say and I think, man, they just said it so well. But you got to get past how they say it and look at the content of what they're saying. And so, atheist Robert Ingersoll at his brother's graveside said this, he had not passed on life's highway the stone that marks the highest point, but being weary for a moment, lay down by the wayside, and using his burden for a pillow, fell into the dreamless sleep that kisses down his eyelids still. While yet in love with life and raptured with the world, he passed to silence and pathetic dust. He said it beautifully. I mean, that is eloquent. But look at what he's saying. Yet after all, he says, it may be best, just in the happiest, sunniest hour of all the voyage, while eager winds are kissing every sail to dash against the unseen rock, and in an instant hear the billows roar above a sunken ship. For whether in mid-sea or among the breakers of the farther shore, a wreck at last must mark the end in each of all. And every life, no matter if it's every hour rich with love and every moment jeweled with joy, will at its close become a tragedy as sad and deep and dark as can be woven of the warp and woof of mystery and death. Life is a narrow veil between two cold and barren peaks of two eternities. We strive in vain to look beyond the heights. We cry aloud, and the only answer is the echo of our wailing cry. From the voiceless lips of the unreplying dead, there comes no word. But in the end, in the night, rather, of death, hope sees a star, and listening love can hear the rustle of a wing. He who sleeps here when dying, mistaking the approach of death for the return of health, whispered with his last breath, I'm better now. Let us believe, in spite of doubts and dogmas and tears and fears, that these dear words are true of all the countless dead. That almost sounds like he's saying we want to have a hope of heaven. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is our hope is that when we die, we're dead and that's it. And let's hope that's the case. You could contrast this with something like what Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 4, that we do not sorrow as those who have no hope. That when someone passes away who's in Christ, someone dies in the Lord, that though there is sorrow, it is not as though there is no hope. There is hope, and that's what the gospel teaches us. Now, to get an idea of how difficult it is for atheists to explain morality, I want to turn to one of the more modern outspoken atheists of today, Richard Dawkins. In The Selfish Gene, he wrote, "This book is mainly intended to be interesting, but if you would extract a moral from it, read it as a warning. Be warned that if you wish, as I do, to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly toward a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature. Let us understand what our own selfish genes are up to, because we may then at least have the chance to upset their designs, something that no other species has ever aspired to." Now here, he's just been talking about the idea that, you know, he says, "I'm not advocating morality based on evolution." He's just said, "I'm just saying how things have evolved, that's all. I'm not saying how we ought to behave," he says. Because he doesn't want to be misunderstood, you know. But he says, "My own feeling is that a human society based simply on the genes law of universal ruthless selfishness would be a very nasty society in which to live." He recognizes. And he admits right here that biology does not give us morals. So he says, we've got to upset our own designs, as it were, and try to overcome the way evolution has made us so that we can have a good society. Common good. Of course, he never defines where that comes from or why we need to. Be warned, he says. But to what does Dawkins appeal in order to say all of that? Because if we can expect little help from biological nature when it comes to deciding morality, you've got to appeal to something outside of science. But wait, isn't that what he fusses about religion? Coming to conclusions about reality outside of science? Without any help from science to make moral decisions? He's got to be relying on something else to help him decide what's that standard going to be. Just someone saying, "because I say so," isn't good enough, and it cannot be proven scientifically. So by Dawkins' own reasoning, why should he have any say in matters like this? But I want you to notice he also wrote this in his book, River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life. "In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." Nothing but pitiless indifference. At bottom, there's your foundational worldview language right there. At bottom, there's no good, there's no evil, there's nothing. I'd like to ask him, why should I feel anything but pitiless indifference for his view? Seriously. Because again, there's nothing inherent in biological nature that should give us a concept of pity. So why did it develop at all? And why does it even matter? It's like one cynic said, "God is dead, Marx is dead, and I'm not feeling too well myself." Those who tout nature alone as a determiner of everything are going to have a tough time when it comes to explaining morality, because brute materialism is incapable of explaining one of the most important features of what it means to be human. But there's more. Proverbs 10:25 says, "When the whirlwind passes, the wicked man is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Be consistent with this. Are morals real or are they illusions? Well, you realize that some prominent atheists, have taught this very point, that morals are illusory. Michael Ruse, Florida State University, says this: morality is a biological adaptation no less than our hands and feet and teeth. Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something, ethics, is illusory. I appreciate that when somebody says, love thy neighbor as thyself, they think they're referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, to a Darwinian evolutionist, it can be seen that such reference is truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction and has no being beyond or without this. He continues, morality is an ephemeral product. Ephemeral means temporary. It's a temporary, ephemeral product of the evolutionary process, just as other adaptations. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any deeper meaning is illusory. So if morality is basically an illusion and temporal, and there's no deeper meaning than just the ability to help the evolutionary process, then moral values, they're not real. I mean, if they're illusions, they're not real. You know, if they're going to talk about morality developing, one of the questions I like to ask is, why did immorality develop? If you're going to say that morality developed in order to help the aid and reproduction of society, why did immorality develop? Does evil also help the evolutionary process? If moral values are illusory, is evil also an illusion? David Berlinski noted, if moral statements are about something, then the universe is not quite as science suggests it is, since physical theories, having said nothing about God, say nothing about right or wrong, good or bad. To admit this would force philosophers to confront the possibility that the physical sciences offer a grossly inadequate view of reality, and since philosophers are very much wish to think of themselves as scientists and would offer them an unattractive choice between changing their allegiance or accepting their irrelevance. Now this guy's mathematician, scientist. My point is that any view that makes moral values illusory essentially make themselves irrelevant for making moral judgments and denies the foundation of what we all know to be true about ourselves, that we are moral beings who are accountable and responsible, and it's not just an illusion. But you see, the other problem there is that if all this developed as something that's illusory, what else has Darwinian evolution tricked us into thinking? Now that takes us back to last night where we were asking that question, how can we trust our minds if it came about by mindless forces, chance, accidental processes? And then what about free will? You'd think that the connection between morality and freedom should be pretty clear. That is to say that if we're not free to act, then morality becomes kind of a moot point. Arguing over what cannot be changed or over issues that involve no choice would be both pointless and silly. And the biblical view of free will is that God made us with the ability to make those free moral choices. He gave us the ability to love, which also requires that we have the ability to choose not to love. But love is not love if we don't choose it. So what does the atheist say about free will? Again, I don't say that all atheists would make the same claim here, but I do find it interesting that some of the most prominent ones of today strongly argue that free will is also an illusion. So for example, here's what Jerry Coyne of the University of Chicago wrote. You may feel you've made choices, but in reality, your decision to read this piece, whether to have eggs or pancakes, was determined long before you were aware of it. perhaps even before you woke up today, and your will had no part in that decision. So it is with all other choices. Not one of them results from a free and conscious decision on your part. There is no freedom of choice, no free will. And those New Year's resolutions you made, you had no choice about making them, and you'll have no choice about whether you'll keep them. Our brains are simply meat computers that, like real computers, are programmed by our genes and experiences to convert an array of inputs into a predetermined output. I quoted this some a while back, and somebody asked me, do you mean, did he say our brains are neat computers? I said, no, he said meat computers. Our brains are just surrounded by a bunch of meat, basically. That's it. And remember, if you're a materialist, if all there is brute material, then that's all you can say about it. Chemical neurons firing in the gray matter of your head, that's it. You're just a meat computer, that's it. And similarly, atheist William Provine, in a debate with Philip Johnson, said, there is no intelligent design in the natural world. When mammals die, they're really and truly dead. No ultimate foundations exist for ethics exist. No ultimate meaning in life exists. And free will is merely a human myth. These are all conclusions to which Darwin came quite clearly. Modern evolutionary biology not only supports Darwin's belief in evolution by descent and his belief in natural selection, but all of the implications that Darwin saw in evolution have been strongly supported by evolutionary biology. But yeah, you can't make this up. I mean, these guys are saying, you know, free will is a myth. Morals are illusions. Free will is an illusion. This is all a myth. We're just kind of doing what we're pre-programmed to do, and that's it. It's a worldview where he admits there are no ultimate foundations for ethics. There is no ultimate meaning in life. That's worldview language right there. Contrast that with the biblical view. Sometimes somebody asks, can we be good without God? I believe really that's the wrong question. The real question is, can one even define or grasp good without God? Good as a component of morality is not a material thing extended in space and time. If it is real, materialism cannot account for it. Good without God would be subjective, relative, and non-universal. There's no way to define it, no way to measure it, no way to judge anything based on it, and there could be no expectations of ultimate outcomes from it. Without God, good would just be an arbitrary term with no boundaries, foisted on people by a majority of others who may or may not agree. Yet it wouldn't ultimately matter in the least. Because whether you live this way or that way, when you die, you're done, you're gone, that's it, no more. And you'd never know the difference. And without God, good, like free will, would have to be just an illusion. The material brain would be fooling us into thinking that there is a reality that is good, but that would be a false impression. And good would have no foundation beyond our whims and desires. It has no ultimate intelligent foundation, and no intelligently guided goals. And let me leave you with this question. I don't have time to dig too deep into this, but I just want you to think about this. What's the basis for moral outrage? You ever thought about that? You ever talk to somebody who really becomes outraged at something morally that they think is some kind of great injustice? I mean, you think again, tomorrow night we're going to talk about some of these questions like, where do human rights come from, and why is racism wrong? Because these are issues that people will get morally outraged about. The question is why? Let's just say morals are an illusion. Free will is an illusion. So somebody does something over here that violates somebody's human rights. What's the basis for your moral outrage? Think about it. If there is no God and everything is the product of brute materialistic processes that have no intelligent foundation for their beginning and no ultimate goal or consequence in the end, moral outrage would have to be another one of those biological developments that somehow we think helps us survive, but there would be no meaning beyond that. Like free will and goodness, moral outrage would be nothing more than something rooted only in raw material. And in the end, it wouldn't matter. I believe moral outrage has a foundation. And it's real because morals are real. They're not illusions. It's real because we have an intelligent basis to go back to, a foundation that has ultimate meaning and goodness that underlies it. If you don't believe in God and you believe morality is going to be subjective, it's just what we determine, it's going to be relative, it's not going to be universal, then I would simply say to you, please keep your moral outrage to yourself. Because otherwise you're pushing your own preferences and illusions on others without having an ultimate foundation, and I would simply say no thank you. The fact of moral outrage even points to the reality and the transcendence of morals, which points to a standard to which all are going to be amenable. So, what fits the evidence? Which worldview makes sense of our moral nature again? We are thinking, reasoning, moral beings. Why? How? Which worldview fits what we know to be true about ourselves and our experiences? Which worldview makes sense of right and wrong, good and bad? Who's in the position to define and understand what that even means? But let's not lose sight of the gospel in all this. As we prepare to sing the song that was chosen, I'll come back to what we started with. The essence of the gospel is to announce peace and salvation, to say to Zion, your God reigns, to recognize that God has done something about bad morals. I'm not up here saying that Christians think they're perfect. We're not. We're Christians because we recognize our failure. And we recognize our need for God. We recognize our need for salvation. That's why we're Christians. The issue is not we're Christians because we're morally perfect and shame on the rest of you. The issue is that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and the difference is simply who responds to God's call for salvation. And so we end with an invitation. If you want to share in that peace and salvation and the reign of the King, we would invite you to let us know that. If you need to be baptized into Christ, if you need our help and prayers, whatever we can do to help you, make your way to the front while we stand.